The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to Virtual Curbside. We're talking about ear, nose, and throat issues, otorhinolaryngology issues this month with incomparable Steve Kelly, Primary Children's. Welcome back, Steve.
Thanks, Paul.
We ate a lot of sack lunches together. I think by the end of the 2 years, I think either one of us could have predicted what was going to show up in the other person's lunch.
Well, mine was pretty predictable.
Yeah, mine too. Mine too. But, you know, those were good times. I don't know that you appreciate it in the moment, but those were good times. It was nice spending time with you back then. All right, sir. So we've settled the issue of ears. We've settled the issue of tonsils. So we thought we'd maybe try to tackle something a little broader this week and talk about pediatric head and neck masses. Before we proceed, do you have anything that you'd like to disclose?
Nothing to disclose, Paul.
Well, so as I was in clinic today, because, you know, I was writing on my outlines here that one of my most common questions is, could you take a look at this lump on my child's neck? Predictable as could be. There's just one thing we need you to check. We're a little bothered about these lumps in our child's neck. We get it all the time. So let's try to sort that out. All right. So when we look at trying to look at a useful way to look at these, there are different kinds of neck masses. Kids are born with some. They get infected with some, and they get errant tissue growing in some. Have I summarized those reasonably well?
Yes, those are the general categories for pediatric head and neck masses: congenital, inflammatory or infectious, and then neoplastic.
So why don't you refresh our memory about the basic lay of your land? Could you review neck anatomy and what the importance of those regions is?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to head and neck anatomy. In pediatric otolaryngology, we're dealing with many processes that affect the lymph nodes. There's a few hundred lymph nodes in the neck, and we tend to categorize them at different levels: submental, high jugular digastric, mid-neck, lower anterior neck, posterior neck. Those are general areas of the neck that we divide things into. A lot of that is divided by the sternocleidomastoid muscle. Posterior to that would be the posterior neck masses. Anterior to that, your anterior or lateral neck masses. And then we have midline neck masses right in the midline of the neck. We also have masses that we see originating in the nasopharynx or the sinuses or other areas as well.
Is there any immediate importance to you about where a mass is located? When you ask me, where is it? Obviously, it's to get it situated, but are there going to be assumptions that you make about a mass based on where it is?
Can be. You know, certainly some congenital masses have very typical locations. For instance, branchial cleft remnants, branchial cleft cysts, branchial cleft sinus tracts are in certain areas of the neck along the, you know, anterior border of the sternocleidomastoid. You know, type 1 branchial cleft anomalies are high up around the ear area, parotid area, even at the angle of the jaw. You have thyroglossal duct cysts or midline neck masses. You know, there's a small differential for true midline neck masses. So location is important. Also, location is important to us because certain neck masses may involve the airway. We may be concerned of airway obstruction from certain neck masses, for instance, a lymphatic malformation, cystic hygroma in a young child often involves multiple planes in the neck and can invade into the base of tongue and other areas that may give us concern with management of the airway as well.
The first question I should ask myself when the parents say, we wanted to check some lumps on our child's neck. So if I'm thinking about the location, that may help to drive how I'm looking for what the nature of the mass is?
Can be. And then just the history, you know, I think is very important. Most of the time, we can have a pretty good idea of the nature of a neck mass just based on history, as far as how long has the mass been present? Was it associated with a preceding upper respiratory infection? Is it growing in size? Is it associated with fever? Are there skin changes associated with it? Or has it been draining? So all of these things that we ask in the history, is there associated night sweats, weight loss? You know, some of these types of symptoms will point us in the direction of, is this a congenital, more likely a congenital neck mass, inflammatory or infectious or a neoplastic process?
Which congenital neck masses would lend themselves to long-term observance and which ones should, observation, and which ones should I talk to you about sooner than later?
Well, I think we probably, in a child that has a congenital neck mass, I think getting us involved early is important. And then we can kind of decide from there, is it something that we can watch? For instance, a vascular anomaly, certain vascular anomalies, hemangiomas, et cetera, some of them may grow rapidly in the first year or so of life, but then we would expect involution or decrease in size and even resolution of some of them over time. But if they're affecting the airway, if they're affecting the line of vision, you know, certainly that those are different stories, right? Other neck masses, congenital masses, such as lymphatic malformation, again, sometimes most of those are noted shortly after birth, but sometimes not. Sometimes they will pop up with an acute upper respiratory infection and suddenly enlarge, but still be a congenital mass that either was very small initially or even not noticeable initially, but is there. Many thyroglossal duct cysts are not present at birth. Most of them are not, but most of them are present in the first several years of life, often popping up and becoming noticeable after an acute upper respiratory infection.
And should they see you then?
Yeah, I think it's helpful for us to see many of these. I think the tricky ones are like, you know, the small lymph nodes that we see in many children, you know, these small reactive, sometimes we call them shoddy adenopathy that we see in young children that have frequent upper respiratory infections and have reactive nodes in response to that. Those are, I think, the harder ones sometimes to sort out. But I think in that situation, the worrisome signs would be rapidly growing node or mass, larger than a centimeter and a half in diameter, fixed, so not mobile when you're palpating it, very rock hard, et cetera. So those would be symptoms of a more worrisome mass versus small nodes that are mobile, non-tender, no overlying skin changes that seem to wax and wane in size with acute upper respiratory infections.
It does seem, especially in kids, that there are often lymph nodes in positions where they're easily palpated almost all the time. And one of the things we just do at checkups is we just inventory them again. It seems like if they fit those criteria, that's a safe thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, if they're not enlarging, if they're smaller than a centimeter in size and they're mobile, really mobile, non-tender, no other symptoms, the likelihood of them being something concerning is low. But certainly if they're changing, you know, continuing to grow, you know, or other associated symptoms, weight loss, night sweats, these types of symptoms, then they should be worked up a little more.
Let's talk about the inflammatory masses. What acutely inflamed masses should we be aware of?
So you'll have a variety of different neck abscesses that we see. Many of them arise in a lymph node that becomes suppurative and necrotic and full of pus. So usually those are acute onset, sometimes with upper respiratory symptoms, certainly fever, tenderness, sometimes decreased neck mobility, is associated with those overlying skin erythema cellulitic changes.
Do you have a first choice of antibiotics for those? Would you treat them with antibiotics, or would you just observe them? Or graining?
Yeah, so if they've gone to a full-blown abscess, then usually they're going to require drainage. Now, if you catch the patient early and they have maybe a small early abscess, or you'll often see the reading from the radiologist as a phlegmon, then many of those we can turn around with antibiotics. Many of these patients are admitted to the hospital for IV antibiotics initially to try to, turn them around and keep them out of the operating room. And we'll often use, again, Unison is a good choice. Clindamycin is a good choice. Those are two of our favorite that we use a lot.
What about chronically inflamed masses in the head and neck?
So one of the ones that we not infrequently see a chronic inflammation would be, for instance, atypical mycobacterial infection. Usually they present initially as a node that kind of comes on slowly, grows slowly, usually no associated fever or upper respiratory infection, usually no tenderness, but they tend to kind of grow slowly over time. And then once the atypical mycobacteria infection gets out of the lymph node, they tend to cause necrosis of the node, and then they break out into the surrounding tissue. They get into the subcutaneous tissue, and then you start seeing skin changes of erythema and sometimes fistulization if they go long enough. But it's not an uncommon infection in young children, often in the periparotid region, tail of parotid, submandibular nodes are common areas that we see some of these atypical mycobacterial infections. And they're difficult to treat because they don't respond to the typical antibiotics.
What kind of investigation would you do for those? Is there a particular kind of imaging that would be helpful?
Yeah, I think CT imaging is often helpful in those situations, especially if there's some surrounding cellulitic changes around the nodes or involving the skin. They'll have pretty typical appearance on a CT scan. Ultrasound can be helpful, but I think in the situation of acute infection, where we're looking for abscess formation, especially deep neck abscess formation, CT with contrast is better than ultrasound. Ultrasound, I think, is very helpful in evaluating some smaller nodes. Sometimes it can be helpful, or certainly with midline neck masses, ultrasound is very helpful in that situation.
Any other unusual inflammatory masses that we should be thinking about?
Again, I think depends a little on history. You know, you can ask travel history, you can ask exposure to different animals. You know, if they've been around rabbits and they have an inflammatory mass in the neck, you know, certainly tularemia comes to mind. I've seen a few cases of that over the years. We were suspicious of that based on their exposure to rabbits. You have cat scratch disease. If they have a cat at home and have, a painful suppurative node in the neck that's been a chronic inflammation, that we might consider that. But again, I think with head and neck masses, again, the history, I think, is extremely helpful.
Trouble with kids is they've always had a recent respiratory infection. So it's probably a good idea to think broadly as well.
I think you do. I think sometimes we always have to remember that common things are common and rare things are rare, right? Sometimes we get going down a path maybe too quickly on the rare stuff, but we do see some of those unusual things for sure.
And that's one of the things we talk about a lot on this podcast is that's the beauty of collaboration, right? That's things about being able to get someone like you on the phone and say, what else should I be thinking about?
Right.
Well, let's talk about neoplastic masses, because when you're talking about neoplasm, that the first response to that is always horror, but a fair number of kids' neoplastic masses are actually benign, right? We see a lot of lumps that don't mean very much. You want to talk us through some of those, like epidermal cysts, lipomas?
Yeah. So like a dermoid cyst, pyelomatrixoma, some of these masses are not uncommon in children, especially dermoid cysts. in that situation, you know, that's, again, the history, I think it can be very, very helpful. Dermoid cysts are also found in pretty typical locations. For instance, in the brow, in the lateral brow area is a common area for dermoid. In the midline of the neck, along the course of where you might see a thyroglossal duct cyst, many of those are dermoid cysts. Once they get lower in the neck, suprasternal notch area, we see some dermoid cysts as well. So those are often, and sometimes we'll see them on the scalp and things like that. So they're often just slow growing, asymptomatic masses, usually non-tender, no associated fever, no associated upper respiratory infection, no skin changes. Usually they're mobile on examination, very well demarcated, smooth surface, and quite mobile. So a lot of times, just with the history and a little physical exam, you can narrow it down pretty quickly as well. A pilomatrixoma is another, you know, subcutaneous mass of skin structures underneath the skin. They're pretty typical in the fact that their surface is very irregular. Once they get of any size, they're often adherent to the dermis. And when you palpate them, you can feel a little, almost like calcifications, irregularities in the mass. And, you know, subcutaneous mass, a little bit more fixed, often not as mobile. And they have fairly typical appearance on ultrasound or CT scan.
Any of those have a high need to be removed aside from the fact that they're often in spots that you can see them?
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to go away. And so usually we're going to remove them at some point. Now, say it's a very young child, we can wait a little bit, especially with dermoids. They tend to grow very slowly. They don't tend to be adherent to the skin. They don't tend to invade other structures, but they will grow slowly over time. And sometimes they can be a problem. Pimple popper type size, right? Mm-hmm. We would usually go ahead and remove them. They're a little easier to remove before they get super large, right? Sometimes they can recur. If you don't excise the entire cyst or leave some of the capsule behind, they will recur. So when they're smaller, they're a little easier to remove, but it's not like an emergent thing. Pilomatrixomas, I would love to remove those when they're smaller. They can be much more challenging to completely remove with higher rate of recurrence, the larger they get, and the more they involve the skin. Sometimes you have to resect some of the skin if they're very adherent to the skin or they'll come back.
So with the pilomatrixomas, as soon as possible. With the others, is there an optimal timing?
Not necessarily. I think, certainly we don't like putting really young kids under anesthesia, 6 to 9 months of age. I think you get them beyond that, the risk of anesthesia goes down. So, and if you can wait a little bit longer even, it may be a little bit better.
Let's talk about some of the bad tumors. You've said several times already that we should be watching with constitutional signs and associated signs and symptoms. You've mentioned lymphoma. Anything else you want to share about lymphoma, and especially from your perspective?
So lymphoma is fairly common in kids. The head and neck area is a fairly common site. Usually, they're often single large lymph nodes, or maybe a few very large lymph nodes that enlarge fairly quickly and don't go down. They're often kind of rubbery in consistency, so you can get an idea sometimes on physical exam that this may be suspicious. Those patients, as part of their workup, they need a chest x-ray too, because sometimes we'll see mediastinal masses, mediastinal lymphoma involvement that can be problematic when we put them under anesthesia. Sometimes the mass in the mediastinum is so compressive that we lose control of the airway in those situations. I have seen a few cases of nasopharyngeal lymphoma. And the key there is to always be suspicious. They're rare, but they do occur. Those patients often have very severe symptoms of nasal obstruction. When we scope them in the clinic with a nasopharyngoscope, they just have massive adenoid enlargement. Tonsillar lymphoma is pretty rare. Again, they often have associated cervical adenopathy, and then you see the unilateral tonsillar enlargement, which is another topic. Maybe we get into that in the question and answer. That might be something that we discuss as well.
Yep. Let's plan to do that. What about nasopharyngeal carcinoma?
So nasopharyngeal carcinoma in kids, pretty rare. We certainly see nasopharyngeal rhabdomyosarcoma more than say carcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma is pretty unusual in children, very common in adults. But we see a nasopharyngeal rhabdomyosarcoma, you know, we might see a case or two a year of that. And those are usually pretty devastating. They often present very late. And we don't see them until they're having intracranial symptoms. Some of those, you know, when tumors that arise in the nasopharynx sometimes can present with middle ear effusion. So if we have an older child that's kind of never had a history of ear problems and they have a middle ear effusion that arises, whether it's unilateral or bilateral, we have to be suspicious of something going on in the nasopharynx that's obstructing the eustachian tubes causing middle ear effusion. And often we'll pick up the nasopharyngeal tumor that way. We'll see an effusion, we'll scope the nasopharynx and say, oh, there's a mass here. We need to image it and then biopsy it because this is, you know, unusual.
So I guess the thing to think about there is a common thing happening in an uncommon setting.
Right.
How about neuroblastoma in the head and neck?
We see it, again, not super common, but we can see neuroblastoma as well.
As it turns out, 99% of this, 99% plus, I get used to saying, yeah, that looks normal. It's just the ones that give you a stomach ache that I need to call you about, right?
That's right. That's a good mantra, I guess.
On the issue of head and neck masses, are there themes of things that you wish people like me were more tuned into in getting them to see you sooner?
No, I think most primary care physicians, most pediatricians do a good job. In my experience, they do a good job of getting patients in to see us. They'll usually call us and say, look, I'm concerned about this. Can you get them in? And I think that works out really well. I think the biggest thing, I think, is communication. You mentioned that in maybe one of our other discussions, but I think good communication between the primary care physician and the otolaryngologist is very helpful.
I think that's the key to so much of what we do. You know, I think that we're trained to be eyes and ears. I think there's something about medical training that sometimes makes us embarrassed to say, I feel in over my head right now, but I don't think that's the way it's supposed to work. I think the reason why we specialize is so that we can share expertise and collaborate. The key being that we share what we know and what we know how to do to take good care of kids.
Right.
Steve, thanks so much for your time this month. This has been very, very illuminating. Nice to catch up a little bit as well. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com. Make sure and like and subscribe wherever you download your favorite podcasts. And thanks to Elisa Stoddard for making this sound like a podcast. Thanks for listening, Janice. We'll talk to you next week, Steve.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.